Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
I don't think people look at the gerontocracy in the Senate right now and say, okay, they're going to figure out AI.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. And of course, the purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly fixating on the problems themselves. Joining us this week is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, representing Massachusetts 6th District around Salem, Mass. He is currently running for U.S. Senate against Democratic incumbent Ed Markey with a big primary coming up. Seth, it's always good to see you.
It's great to see you too, John. And I got to tell you, you know, one of the first pieces of political advice I've gotten that I've always remembered is from someone who worked for me very early on. And he said, you know, it's not enough just to get on TV and complain. You got to give people a vision of the future. And I think that's something that Democrats especially need to do right now. But I love that that's kind of the theme of your podcast.
Thanks, man. Well, look, you know, we started this when I was running for Congress, and I talked to you about that decision. But it seems to me that's the conversation we need to be having in politics and in journalism. And a lot of journalists are frankly scared, I think, of talking about policy because it might look like they're advocating. But at the end of the day, if we don't have an engaged citizenry that feels that we can actually deal with our problems and get excited by those rather than feeling overwhelmed by the scale of the difficulty, then folks just kind of curl up. And that's the opposite of what we need to be as citizens. So I appreciate that. All right. So let's dig into your policies in the context of this primary. You put forward sort of a new vision for the Democratic Party. Not surprisingly, first top two items are age limits and term limits. Explain.
Look, I think it's just a reality right now that people are saying there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party that are really old. And then look at our president. I mean, he's going senile before our eyes. And so maybe the founding fathers would have put upper age limits just like they put lower age limits if people had lived this long back in the day. I mean, I served in the Marines with some of the most extraordinary Americans, some of the most amazing leaders I have ever met in my life. There were 22-year-olds. There were some 20-year-olds taking on responsibilities with far greater skill and principle, morality, and everything else than many of my colleagues in Congress. And yet we've kind of come to this consensus that it's okay to have 26 be the age limit where you just can't run for Congress if you're not 26. I think it's reasonable to talk about an upper age limit as well.
And what do you think that is in practice? I mean, you know, you support term limits as well. And to me, it's like, you know, if you've been 18 years in the Senate and, you know, then I don't know, maybe you're going to get a lot more done in your 24th year. But what's the age limit you think needs to be in place? 80?
I don't really know. I mean, there's a lot of people who say 80. There's some states that are floating 80. The limit for judges in Massachusetts is 70. So somewhere in there. And the point is that just like there are some extraordinarily talented 24-year-old leaders who can't run for Congress, there are going to be some extraordinarily talented 78, 80, maybe even 82-year-old people who just get timed out. But that's okay. That's okay. That's a reasonable compromise to make to ensure that we don't have another Biden, Feinstein, or Ruth Bader Ginsburg situation.
So those are all really specific elements. And then there was you know, Ted Kennedy, when he was ill, and the implications that had for Obama and majority proof of the Senate. It does seem that there's a holding on for reasons that might reflect that person's own sense of purpose rather than the good of the republic. And I think that's where, like, we forget this is not supposed to be a lifetime appointment. This isn't judges. This is what you're supposed to do for a season of your life, to do good service and then go back home, pull a Cincinnatus. Why did we get away from that, do you think?
Well, and hopefully encourage and mentor other people to come in with new ideas and different perspectives. I mean, I don't think people look at the gerontocracy in the Senate right now and say, okay, they're going to figure out AI. You know, they're going to make sure that kids like our kids' age are going to actually be able to survive and thrive in this new economy that's transforming before our eyes. And the sort of running joke in the Senate is that half the Senate can't even spell AI. That's how little they know about it. And so it is time for a new generation of leadership. But even as one of the youngest members of Congress when I started, I very early on founded Serve America, an organization to recruit, mentor, and support other veterans, National Service veterans, so military veterans, but also City Year, AmeriCorps veterans, who want to serve the country in Washington, with the theory that maybe some people who've had some experience serving the country before will bring that service ethic to Congress. And so I have worked for a while on bringing new people into politics. And Mikey Sherrill, Abigail Spanberger, who won those incredibly important gubernatorial races on the East Coast, Alyssa Slotkin and Andy Kim, who are already in the Senate, Johanna Hayes, Chrissy Houlihan, Jason Crow, great leaders in the House. I mean, these are all people that I helped bring in. And I think that's good. That's good for the institution. I don't think it should be enough just to get yourself reelected.
For sure, it's not. That was not the founder's intent. But I think you're zeroing in on something important. It's not only important for the Republic, but I think it's particularly important for the Democratic Party, which since Vietnam has been tagged and tarred unfairly with the idea that it is weak on national service, weak on military experience, weak on national security. And in fact, I want to argue this with you right now, is that you and I are both members of what are sometimes called the 9/11 generation. You know, I lived it up close. Many folks served in the wake of that terror attack. And it's interesting to me that for all the politicization of that moment by largely Republicans who were in power, that when you look at the leading members of the 9/11 generation serving in Congress and governors right now, they seem to be center left. And I want to underline center left. But it's interesting that you know, that seems to be where the energy and the collective conscience of the 9/11 generation went, to the center left. Why do you think that is?
Well, look, I think there were a lot of Republicans who were really dishonest about the war. I mean, Bush, remember, was the one, of course, who said, oh, we got to go to Iraq for WMD. And sadly, there were a lot of even Democrats who believed those lies naively. Of course, mostly Republicans, though. Republicans were cheerleaders for those wars for a long time. I mean, as a veteran of Iraq, having served four tours there myself, it's not lost on me that I'm running against an 80-year-old incumbent who voted for the war. One of the Democrats who said, yeah, hey, let's do it. Let's go to Iraq. Had nothing to do with 9/11, but sure, let's give it a shot. And I think that was a really bad decision. But I think the point is that the Republican Party in general has had to have a reckoning with supporting wars, cheerleading for wars, just because they were started by Republican presidents, when they don't always make a lot of sense. And that brings us to today,
where it's extraordinary. Seth. I mean,
it's extraordinary that all these Republicans in Congress, I mean, people who are pretty reasonable behind the scenes, even asking tough questions of the administration behind the scenes, are trying to make this Iran excursion, as the president calls it, out to be a good idea. We're losing this war across the board. It's a disaster for us.
Let's dig into that. I mean, with the exception of the Rand Pauls and the Thomas Massies, who were being demonized for their consistent opposition, the fact that this happened this way, no selling of the war to the American people, apparently kind of an impulsive decision by the president and the Pentagon, where things like the Strait of Hormuz, which were always a factor in strategy discussions, seem to have been discounted. You say we're losing the war. I mean, certainly the leadership of the Islamic Republic has been damaged, degraded, or dead. But how did we blunder into this? What the kind of behind-the-scenes inquiry that's going on, and are Republicans being honest about it?
No, they're not. They're not being honest at all, because some of them do actually ask tough questions in classified sessions on the Armed Services Committee, reasonable questions, even backing up some of the questions that Democrats like me ask. And yet then they go out and just vote to continue the war. Then they get on TV and say, oh, it's going great. You know, we had to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Well, guess what? The Islamic Republic has been around for 50 years. They've been working on nuclear stuff for a long time. I very much believe that they would like to have a nuclear weapon. Certainly many elements of the regime do. And yet every previous president has managed to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon without starting a war and without inviting them to close the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, so it's a disaster. But it's also worth just going through all the different rationale really quickly for what Trump has said he wanted to do, right? Because I actually would argue that there has been regime change. You've replaced an 86-year-old in failing health who had a fatwa against ever building a nuclear weapon with a guy in his 50s who, in case he wasn't more hardline, you killed all of his immediate family. And there's a lot of reason to believe that he will just rush to produce a bomb. He's certainly more controlled by the hardline IRGC element of that regime.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. Reese, our content agent, wrote the copy based on our best practices, like mentioning Monday.com 3 times. That was the second. Johnny, our coordination agent, built the timeline and kept everyone aligned. Olivia, our human creative director, stayed in the loop because agents are great, but they don't always know when a joke lands. She had one note: tell listeners it only takes minutes to build an agent. So, minutes. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. Want to bring a little Hollywood excitement to your day? Take a few spins with Chumba Casino's brand new game, Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways. It's free and features 10,000 ways to play, giving you nonstop action, including thrilling bonus respins and cascading reels. Every spin brings something new, so step into the spotlight, enjoy the excitement, and play today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Then there was oil. Trump said it was for oil. Well, that's not gone very well. I mean, people are paying over $4.50 at the pump right now. And he said it was about ballistic missiles. And sure, we destroyed a bunch of their ballistic missiles, but they'll rebuild them. Or maybe they'll just buy a bunch of even more sophisticated ballistic missiles than they ever had from China with the $14 billion that Trump gave them by lifting the oil sanctions on Iran in the middle of the war. I mean, just to let that sink in, they kill 14 Americans. And in response, we say, oh, no worries. Why don't you sell your oil now? And they've gotten $14 billion just so far.
Dig into that for a second. It's completely insane. Not only that, but we also lifted the embargoes on Russia.
Oh, that's right. We want to give all our national security adversaries and Trump's good buddies friends. I mean, it's actually not surprising at all that he lifted sanctions on Putin, because he's always looking for excuses to do something nice for Putin, right? He has a 90-minute phone call with Putin, and then the next day he pulls 5,000 troops out of Germany, weakening NATO, right? So that's not a surprise. I just didn't know that Trump was such good friends with the Ayatollahs in Iran.
I think what we're seeing is that for large elements of the Trump administration, it's all about the money, in addition to for someone who campaigned against foreign wars, I mean, I think this is the 9th country we've attacked. But there's no easy way out of this, to your point. You've had some highly televised clashes with Pete Hegseth, questioning his honesty and his leadership in this. Just, what is the state?
Basic competence, John. I think I'm just questioning his basic competence. But yeah, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
No. I mean, dig into that for a second, because he seems to have, he's just firing, the head of the Navy during the war, firing the head of the Army during a war. The Army head was someone deeply respected within the military. who does that during a war? What is the game plan? Or is this all just personal petty politics and flexing?
The person who does that during the war is someone who's deeply insecure. And the reason that Hegseth is sticking around is because he has a lot in common with his boss, another deeply insecure man. I think Trump probably likes the fact that Hegseth has a history of being accused of sexual abuse, multiple wives, people who have disliked, distrusted him for a long time, because Trump identifies with all that, because it's the same experience for him. And while Hegseth plays petty politics with top officials at the Pentagon, I think he's fired almost two dozen flag officers now in the midst of a war, in the midst of national security challenges all around the globe. Nobody in the Pentagon trusts anybody right now. It's chaos and disarray behind the scenes. We hear this repeatedly as officials from the Pentagon come and testify before our committee and have meetings with us on the side. Everyone's afraid that they say one thing out of line, they'll get fired. I mean, that is a hallmark of the Soviet military. That's a hallmark of the Chinese Communist Party, ideological loyalty. It's the opposite of that that has always made America the best country on earth and made our military far and away the best military on earth, because you're able to question things. You're able to have intellectual debate. But now if you're a colonel who gets himself into Harvard, you can't go because Hegseth just doesn't like Harvard. No matter that the troops want to go there, you just can't go. And a whole bunch of other schools are on that list as well. So the long-term damage that Hegseth is doing to the military because of petty politics is unbelievable. But there's something I want to talk about as well, which is that if you go back to 2015, when Trump ripped up that nuclear deal, it's really useful to think about that now, given where we are today. Because he's fundamentally trying to get another nuclear deal. So, okay, if this guy wants a nuclear deal, why did he rip up the first one? Petty politics. He did it despite Obama. It was Obama's deal, and so he had to rip it up because he is a deeply insecure, petty man.
That's what needs to be underlined here, right? I mean, this was a disagreement that led in part to the firing of H.R. McMaster. And I remember at the time, Secretary of State Pompeo kept saying that the reason they had to get rid of the nuclear deal was to stop Iran from getting a bomb, which was like accepted and repeated, even though it was, you know, it was bizarro world backwards. But now, you know, there are reports they're basically going to get a new JCPOA, but at a much higher dollar amount to Iran. How real is that? I mean, from what you understand.
I don't think it's very real at all because of this war, we've given Iran more leverage. I mean, now we're not only trying to get a nuclear deal from them, we're trying to get the Strait opened, which has never been closed before. Even Jimmy Carter with his hostage crisis didn't allow them to close the Strait. But Hegseth and Trump have. But the point about this nuclear deal is also the fact that back in 2015, we had an alternative path. Because if Trump had held on to that deal instead of ripping it up out of spite, then three things would have happened. One, it would have prevented Iran from having a nuclear weapon, because that was the first line in the deal. And Trump's administration itself certified they were following the deal. But the second thing is it would have formed a foundation for building more deals on top of it. That's what usually happens. You know, it was a lot of work to get the first nuclear deal with the Soviets, but then we had subsequent deals that built on that foundation. And that could have been happening too. So all the critics who said, well, it should have included ballistic missiles. Okay, well, just show that you will follow this deal, and then you can build on another one. You can build a deal on ballistic missiles. You could build a deal on proxies. And the third thing that would have all done is continue to empower the moderates in Iran, the opposite of what we've done right now, where the hardliners are on the ascendancy because they've just been proven right that you can't trust the West. Well, there are a lot of moderates in Iran who took a real political risk to do this nuclear deal with Obama. They're the ones who would have been empowered. They're the ones who are supported by the protesters in the streets, tens of thousands of whom have been massacred when Trump promised to bail them out, but he had all his military in Venezuela, so he couldn't do it. So right. There's an alternate history here that I think would have gotten us to a place where not only would we have contained Iran's nuclear weapons program, but we would also have a much more moderate, maybe even a pro-Western government in Iran at this point. But all of that went out the window when Trump tore up the deal.
Right. And obviously nationalism is a net effect of having bombs dropped on your country, no matter how despotic the regime is.
I like to say, if you have a whole bunch of pro-American Iranians, what's the number one way you can turn them against you?
Bomb them.
Actually, I think that's the number two way. The number one way is to bomb them with the Israelis. And that's what we've done.
In June, we did a strike with the Israelis to knock out their weapons production with deep bunker bombs. It was sort of an Oserac type attack, something, you know, I think there's a good history of doing. And we were assured, of course, that the nuclear, you know, facilities were obliterated. And then, of course, that flies completely in the face of the rationale for the latest attack and now the spiraling war. And all the knock-on effects. What's the best explanation? Are they even trying to square that circle? What are they telling members of Congress about why? Are they saying we were wrong? We lied? Or just Israel presented President Trump with a different scenario?
They're literally telling us nothing. Amazingly, after the controversy over the fact that they clearly had not obliterated the nuclear sites, they classified everything regarding Iran nuclear sites at some special classification level, the sort of crown jewels of the United States intelligence apparatus, only available to the White House, so that they cannot do or they won't do their constitutional duty of keeping Congress informed. So just to be clear, this intelligence about Iran's nuclear facilities has never been classified in this compartmented program before. But they did it so that they don't have to explain what's going on to Congress. And the point is that, yes, you took the answer out of my mouth. They lied. That's what's going on. They won't tell us the truth. And as a result, we have a very dangerous situation where even some of our top military commanders are trying to make plans about operations involving their nuclear weapons. Like maybe they want to go back and bomb them again. And they do not have access to the intelligence that describes the state of those programs.
Sorry, the military doesn't have access to the state of the intelligence?
This intelligence is held at such a high classification level that members of Congress who with the need to know, so if you're on a committee of jurisdiction, like I am on the House Armed Services Committee, we are supposed to, by law, have access to all intelligence. So there are very, very few exceptions to that rule. But this applies to the military as well. So no, that's right. The very senior Pentagon planners will not have access to this intelligence because of how they have reclassified it. That's a very dangerous move to protect the lies of Hegseth and Trump that they obliterated the program.
That's insane.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I want to ask you about two knock-on effects, one of which you've spoken out about, which is we have degraded a lot of our missiles and conventional weapons in the context of this excursion, as the president would call it, and pick your day, it's either on or off. Explain to folks why that reveals a strategic weakness in America and what we can do to fix it.
First of all, we don't have enough of these to begin with. And those of us serving on the China Committee who want to do everything we can to deter and prevent a war with China in the Pacific have often for years now talked about the magazine depth problem, where we just don't have enough of the missiles that we need to stop a Chinese invasion of Taiwan in the Pacific. So for years now, we've said we need to get more of these. Well, we just did the exact opposite. We shot them all trying to take out very crude or relatively crude Iranian drones and missiles. So every time we shot a $3 million missile to take down a $50,000 drone, that's not a good ratio. That's not a good cost ratio for us. Every time we did that, we also just slightly decreased our deterrence in the Pacific, the place where we might actually have World War III if China decides to invade Taiwan. So this big strategic picture is incredibly dangerous for our national security. And that's why, while Hegseth is losing this war on the ground today, Iran has more leverage now than they did before they started. On almost every measure, Iran is in a stronger position, or at least has the cash to get itself into a stronger position. But that's kind of at the tactical operational level. At the strategic level, when you look at the whole globe, this has been a big, big blunder.
Well, our allies are not standing with us. The American people weren't made a case. And now there's a sense that, you know, you can simply declare victory, mission accomplished, so to speak, and go home. And that's not the way this works.
The only ones benefiting from this are the Iranians, the Russians, and George W. Bush, because he no longer has the biggest strategic blunder of the 21st century with the Iraq War. Trump's taken that title from him.
Right. Despite having campaigned against that consistently. I want to ask you about how concerned you are about the knock-on effect. One of the things I remember, I've interviewed some folks who did counterterrorism on this podcast. A lot of the FBI's efforts, for example, had been redirected from counterterrorism before the Iran war to immigration enforcement. Yeah. You have, in the spirit of khakistocracy, ruled by the incompetent and the sycophantic, the downstream is, you've got Heritage, Foundation interns, in sensitive positions doing counterterrorism at the Department of Homeland Security. How concerned are you about our ability to monitor the terror threats that will inevitably come as a result of this, given the politicization of national security under the Trump administration?
It's a great question, John, and I'm very concerned because there's always a baseline terrorist threat. And we have diligent national security professionals who have worked for two decades now, they were working on this before, of course, but especially since 9/11, an attack that you experienced up close and personal, they've worked on this to prevent major terrorist attacks on the United States ever since. Well, now most of those professionals have been fired and they've been replaced by ideological plants, like you say, Heritage interns or whatever, who were totally incompetent to do this work. But then on top of that baseline threat, we know that Iran has this in their playbook, that one of the ways that they want to hit back at the United States is to conduct terrorist attacks on our soil, maybe assassinate some of our leaders, maybe blow up schools or something, because we did that to them. I mean, these are really dangerous times because of the Iranian threat on top of everything else. And all this that Trump is doing, from putting Kash Patel at the FBI and firing a whole bunch of people from there to dismembering their counterterrorism units so that they can focus on immigration enforcement. I mean, all of this makes Americans much, much less safe. So, I mean, it's like holding your breath every day that our enemies don't figure this out and conduct another major terrorist attack on American soil.
And we should also remind folks that Trump cut the security details that were tasked and maintained under President Biden to his own senior right. officials, including his Secretary of State, related to the Soleimani strike. So, I mean,
that's right. And of course, all of this is in the context of Trump quite successfully pulling the wool over the eyes of a lot of people who support him by saying, oh, when he said, oh, no, the real national security threat were all these people coming across the border. Now, look, I'm not an open borders Democrat. I mean, I think we've got to have a reasonable immigration system. I'm not saying that I want open borders, but that was nothing compared to the national security threat that we experienced today under Donald Trump. And so there are some Americans, I mean, at least half the country, who think that things were actually safer under Trump. And that is a very naive view.
100%. Before we get to domestic politics, because I do want to go there and talk about some solutions you've put forward. Spoiler alert, and don't turn off at this, Seth Moulton is a high-speed rail nerd. I want to talk about China. You're on the China committee, as you just mentioned. President Trump scheduled to meet with President Xi. My concern going back to Ukraine is that all of this creates an environment where you know, a lack of deterrence, a lack of will, the yellow lights that, you know, Trump and Vance have flashed to China regarding Taiwan, the TikTok subordination just this week. It was an analysis confirmed that TikTok was leaning towards Republicans in key states mm-hmm. in the 2024 election. What are you keeping an eye out for in that summit?
What Trump's going to give in to Xi on, what he's going to give away. Because the concern from Democrats and Republicans alike is he's going to sell the farm. He wants a successful summit because his trade warfare with his tariffs completely backfired. China called his bluff, slapped all these restrictions or tariffs on us, and most importantly, restricted the sale of critical you know, rare earth minerals that are critical for our defense industrial complex, for our electronics industry and everything else. And so once again, Trump has managed to hand more leverage to our adversary. So Xi is going into this summit riding high, trying to get more reductions on the restrictions that not only the Biden administration, but the first Trump administration took on exporting chips to China, the most advanced chips that we don't want them to get, so that they, because we don't want them to beat us in the AI race. So Xi is going in riding high, thinking like, well, I've really got them by the neck now, because I've got I'm holding this Damocles sword over their critical over the rare earth mineral supply, and we're just holding our breath to try to see if Trump can get out of this without giving them even more.
We should note, and tell me if you've heard the same thing, that by many accounts, it's the Treasury Secretary that's actually running China policy. Scott Bessent, not the Secretary of State, that it's primarily being viewed as an economic obstacle or opportunity rather than a national security question primarily. Does that track with what you've been hearing?
It does. And the question that I have, by the way, John, is where is Marco? What is Marco right. doing? Because he's not negotiating with Iran, even though we're in the middle of a war. He's not running China policy, even though we've got this major summit coming up against our biggest adversary on the planet. Where is Marco? What is he doing?
That's like he's the Secretary of State of the Western Hemisphere.
That's right. That's right. He's talking to the Cubans. Forgot.
Right. Right. You mentioned tariffs, and I want to go there as a segue. You said that, you know, Democrats need to have their own proposals to counter Trump, particularly on trade. One of the phrases I like is free trade with free nations. Tell me where you are with what the Democratic Party should be doing about tariffs and trade.
I think that's right. I mean, Trump's tariff policy has been a disaster, but that doesn't mean there's never a place for smart, well-positioned tariffs that are reasonable to try to achieve certain goals where trade is not fair. Because it's not fair if other nations play by different rules, even though the goal is to have free trade. That's an economic benefit to all. I mean, we can kind of learn that in economics 101, but you can't have other nations just taking advantage of us. So very smartly applied tariffs to get certain trade outcomes are a good thing. And the Democratic Party should be, you know, should be supportive of that. And this is one of the problems with Democrats in general right now is we're just sort of reflexively against everything Trump does. And we're only known for being anti-Trump. We've got to have our own plans, our own economic plans, our own national security plans, our own affordability plans. I mean, this is stuff that I'm putting out in my campaign, and I'm thrilled that some other campaigns are picking it up. But the point is, we're not getting this from the party establishment.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No. And I do think there's a danger that Democrats are looking at a strong wave cycle and, you know, the pendulum swing of politics and say, see, our problems are fixed. But that's winning by virtues of the other guys losing. And we got to have our own ideas and our own identity, you know, the Democratic Party. And, you know, so you think actually focusing on free trade with free countries and tariffs against a hostile foreign power like China, you know, that actually is actually about enforcement regime and a reasonable thing to do. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's nothing like the across the board tariffs that Trump put in place and then totally backfired. So we had to chicken out on them. But smart trade policy uses tariffs as one of your tools. Now, that's not the whole economic plan for Democrats. I mean, I've put forward the most aggressive and progressive affordability agenda of any elected Democrat I know today.
All right, let's dig into that.
It plants the flag in the ground, John, and says that housing, healthcare, and education are just human rights. Like that, like maybe that should be our 3 for 30 in response to Republicans' Project 2025. Housing, healthcare, and education, just human rights, not debatable. Everyone deserves them. Everyone will get them. Under the Democrats, that's a non-negotiable. And then we can talk about things like banning private equity from buying up neighborhoods and raising the prices on single family homes, on universal pre-K, and what a difference that would make for education, but also for childcare, because universal pre-K is education, but it also takes kids off the hands of working parents. That's really important for the economy. And doing things to ensure that while Republicans try to take away healthcare from 25 million Americans with their big, beautiful bill, Democrats are strengthening and improving Obamacare to bring down costs and make sure that everybody in America has healthcare, no ifs, ands, or buts. So that's the kind of forward-looking agenda that we need to have. But the broader point here is that if to what you just said earlier, if Democrats win this election just based on Trump opposition, first of all, we're not going to win by much. Like, we might win the House with a whimper and we probably won't take the Senate. But on the other hand, if we meet this moment with a real agenda, with real plans, because when people are hurting and scared, they don't just want resistance. They want leadership. And leadership means having ideas. It means having our plan to fix immigration. It means finally Democrats taking back leadership on the economy. When most voters in America have trusted Republicans more on the economy since Reagan. It means Democrats putting forward leaders like our veterans, like Jason Crow, Abigail Spanberger, Mikey Sherrill, Chrissy Houlihan, to lead on national security and show that while Trump is making us less safe all across the world and losing a war to Iran, we're going to be in it to win it. We are the strong party on national security. Imagine if out of this election, we turn all that history from Reagan around, and going forward for the next several decades, Democrats are the party that's trusted more on the economy. Democrats are the party that's trusted more on national security. Well, we're just not going to do that if we stick to the same establishment that let us lose to a convicted felon and has not really had any plans other than just purely opposing Trump.
You know, and Trump, for the most part, has plans that, at least on healthcare, it's always 2 weeks away. And it's, so let's talk about healthcare. You propose basically a public option on a national level. So expanding the national option so that people can buy in, essentially vote with their feet or their wallets. Tell us how that would work. Are there age limits around that? How do you think that works?
Well, it's essentially like Medicare for all who want it. So if you want to keep the healthcare plan you have, you can have that. It's not going to force everybody onto a one-size-fits-all Medicare for all, but it will have many of the advantages of a public healthcare program like that, including pushing down prices, improving outcomes, but remaining in a competitive marketplace. This is what President Obama wanted when he proposed Obamacare, yep. But they were not able to get it through Congress. It would ensure that everybody in America has health care, but it also ensures there's still competition in the market, which as someone who goes to the VA, a truly one-size-fits-all government program for veterans, I can tell you, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of government health care. There are some things the VA does brilliantly, and I actually have a great VA up here in Massachusetts. There are other VAs that are really terrible, and there are a lot of things where the VA fails. And so So the point is, as someone who's actually experienced government healthcare, I don't think we should force that down people's throats, but we want it to be an option for everybody.
Pro-choice across the board. Let's talk about affordability, affordable housing. You connect it to high-speed rail.
That's right.
Come on. There's no other place you're going to get to nerd out on quite as great detail as this. So talk about how you tie those two things together.
Well, let's bring it home to Massachusetts. You know, in Massachusetts, we've got Boston, the whole Boston economy out east. But then we got the amazing city of Springfield that's about two and a quarter hours away by car without traffic. But according to the current plan to improve the existing rail service between Boston and Springfield, it'll be 2.5 hours longer than driving to get there by train. Now, this is actually longer than the trains took in 1950, which is insane. And so what I'm just saying—
How does anybody come up with that? Honest to God.
It's crazy. It's totally crazy. And yet, you know, that's what the senator I'm running against supports. I'm just saying, let's do what the rest of the world is doing. And we know that Japan does it. We know that France does it. How about the fact that Morocco does it? Morocco has one-third the GDP of just Massachusetts, and yet they just completed a high-speed rail line that's just a little bit longer than Boston to Springfield, goes almost 200 miles per hour, and that would mean getting from Springfield to Boston in 40 minutes. That would be transformative. It's for the economy of Springfield, but it would also be transformative for housing options all across the state, because you could live in Springfield and get to work in Boston if that's where your job is, or vice versa, and be home for dinner. The rest of the world does it. There's no reason why we shouldn't have it in America. Let's start with Massachusetts.
And I'm going to push you to go further, because certainly New York State needs it. But, you know, there are some plans that would say, you know, do Boston to Chicago. I mean, there are more ambitious plans.
That's right. So Boston to Chicago, 20 years ago would have been considered a little bit too far for high speed rail. But given how difficult and aggravating it is to travel by plane these days, distances like that are now in the high speed rail market share. Now, no one's talking about taking a high speed train from Boston to Los Angeles. I mean, that would take quite a while. You know, we're talking about 24 hours or something like that. And so most people wouldn't take it, although there would be some who really don't want to fly or just really want to see the country. But the point is that when you look at all these different markets across America where high-speed rail does make sense, not just Boston to Chicago, but Chicago to Atlanta. Chicago to Atlanta is about the same distance as the most popular high-speed rail line in the entire world, Beijing to Shanghai. And what's amazing about these lines is that that's not just good for the economy of Chicago or the congestion at O'Hare or the economy of Atlanta and the congestion at that airport. It's good for all these amazing cities in between that feel very left out right now, because it's great for Indiana. You know, it's great for the middle America states. So the point is, if you put all these different corridors on a map that makes sense for high-speed rail across America, you get a national system. Not because a lot of people will take the train from Boston to LA, but because Boston to Chicago makes sense, and Chicago to Omaha makes sense, and Omaha to Salt Lake City makes sense, and Salt Lake City to Los Angeles makes sense.
And so is the connection to affordable housing then essentially that you increase the radius of where people can live, and it's much cheaper to live in Springfield? Incidentally, this would be great for the NBA Hall of Fame, Basketball Hall of Fame. But is that how it connects, or is there a development component you could see as well?
Yes. I mean, that is correct. That's sort of the first level. The second is that a lot of people love being able to live in a place where they can walk to a train station and get, you know, amazing places very quickly and easily, and not only faster than driving, but often a lot nicer than driving, and certainly way nicer than flying. And so you get a lot of housing that gets developed, not through taxpayer subsidies, but just through the private sector all around these train stations across America. It also decreases regional inequality. Because we all know that, like, let's go to Boston, Chicago, right? We all know that the economy of Chicago is thriving. The economy of Boston is thriving. Syracuse, South Bend, Indiana, Buffalo, not so much. But all of a sudden, those cities are included in this. And that's the
Buffalo and Syracuse advantage. Have great futures if they had something like this. I mean, they've got great futures, period.
Amazing,
but I
right?
agree with you. It'd be transformative.
It'd be totally transformative. And when you just have a highway and airport-based system, as we do today, you leave Syracuse, Buffalo, South Bend, Indiana, they get left off the map because you just can't get there fast enough or the airlines don't serve them. That's what's so transformative about high-speed rail. It reduces regional inequality at a time when it's been exacerbated with our latest economic trends.
Third one on your list, education. Rahm Emanuel's been talking a lot about this. How do you think Democrats lost their way on education and how do you fix it?
I mean, we have lost our way on education. We used to be the leader in Massachusetts and now Mississippi and Alabama are nipping at our heels because they're just using more data-driven decisions in education. And so we've got to get back to the data here. We've got to get back to what actually makes schools work. And we got to get back to accountability. We took away all the testing requirements in Massachusetts. Now there are basically no graduation requirements. That's not accountability. I mean, I'm not even going to believe a high school diploma if there's no graduation requirements. And that just does a terrible disservice to our kids. So there's a lot of things that we need to fix. But one of the most basic changes we need to make is you need to have universal pre-K without exception. We have universal kindergarten, but we should have started at pre-K. Some states like Rhode Island already have it. That's not only good for kids who benefit immeasurably from this. I mean, prison populations go down in 30 years if kids get pre-K when they're toddlers. But also it's really good for the workforce because there are a lot of working parents who can't go to work because they have a really young kid. And if they could have universal pre-K, that's childcare for these kids, that's good for parents as well.
So that's what we call win-win. I'll put one other plug in for one of my favorite pet ideas. You know, not pet, because I think it's core. A, we got to restore civics education. And B, I think we got to have every graduating high school senior be able to take the same naturalization exam as a new immigrant. A new American citizen.
100%. And what good positions for Democrats to take to say, hey, you know what? We can have immigration policy too. We're not so afraid to touch this that we don't even have a policy. One of the things that I've done in town halls across Massachusetts is ask everyone in the room, how many of you are opposed to Trump's immigration enforcement? Every hand goes up. The next I say, how many of you Democrats can describe to me what Democrats' immigration policy is? Not a single hand, John. That's a real problem. This is not some idle issue. This is the number one issue that lost us the 24 election, that we lost across the board to a convicted felon and his cronies. This is the number one domestic issue today as ICE is terrorizing our cities. And up until last week, the government was shut down for the longest shutdown in history over immigration. And yet the opposition party doesn't have a position? That's crazy. My position is very simple. Prosecute ICE. They've actually got to be held accountable, not just abolished, but prosecuted when they break the law. Number two, have an immigration system that actually incentivizes people to come here legally rather than illegally. Because today it's practically easier to walk across the border than it is to go through the bureaucracy to become a citizen. And third, you need a pathway to citizenship for all those families who are part of our community and are here, DACA kids and everyone else. And so we can have a long debate about exactly what the details of the policy are under those three pillars. But the point is, I'm not afraid to get out there and say, yes, that should be our immigration policy. Let's actually have some ideas here. Let's put forward some plans. Let's not leave this to the Republicans. Let's solve these problems ourselves as Democrats. That's called leadership. And I think that when Democrats lead, Democrats win.
I think that's right. You got an obligation to propose, not just oppose. Congressman Seth Moulton, running for the U.S. Senate. It is good to see you, Seth. Thank you for all the ideas on how to fix it and some timely perspectives on the disastrous Iran war. Be well.
John, thank you very much. It's an honor to be on here with you.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better, and that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.